A couple of months ago now, Rick talked about the idea of two kingdoms, right? And I actually wasn't able to be here that night, but I listened to it. And he talked about two kingdoms, one earthly and passing away, and one spiritual and persevering. And the impact of that theological concept on our participation in modern political life. In part, he addressed in a section the argument in many contemporary Christian circles about America as a Christian nation, that it either was or is or at one time was, should be. Rick addressed this issue from a theological perspective, but tonight I want to approach it from a different angle. The idea that America was or should be a Christian nation is undoubtedly a theological concept, but I would argue it's also a fundamentally historical one, being a historian. If Christians are going to be able to understand and participate in an informed way in a debate that's been invoked in a wide variety of circles and policy areas over the last century, including arguments surrounding just recently gay marriage, abortion, prayer in schools, the Ten Commandments on courtroom walls, and a whole host of others, then it behooves us to do our homework. In fact, it seems to me that while Christians should be primarily guided by the theological framework that Rick laid out last time, it seems to me that when this issue comes up in the public arena as a discussion between Christians and non-Christians, it most often focuses on this historical facet of this issue, because that's a common ground in some ways where the argument can take place in a kind of secular sphere. Both sides feel like they can have some sort of purchase on that. So when we make the argument for two kingdoms that Rick laid out last time, whether to Christians or non-Christians, it seems to me we should also be able to give some sort of a historical account of our nation's history that illustrates whether, so to speak, we are arguing with or against the historical grain, or both at the same time, or something else. So in this sense, I guess that instead of giving you a particularly Christian outlook on a contemporary issue, I'm giving you a historical perspective as a Christian on an issue that I think Christians should be able to speak about in an informed way in a really polarized kind of political atmosphere as we try to negotiate the distance between what, you know, Rick said, the city of God and the city of man. So most of my talk tonight comes from this book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? By John Fia, who was also a Lilly Fellow here at Valparaiso in 2000-2001. And actually, I saw him at a conference last weekend, and he was telling me that he sporadically attended this church in 2000-2001. He's now a professor at Messiah College, and the book has been getting a lot of attention in both kind of popular as well as academic circles. I attended a whole conference on the book last week at Notre Dame, attended by some of the kind of most eminent American religious historians and American historians, period. And Fia tries in the book to approach the issue in a very kind of even-handed historical way. In fact, he approaches it in such an even-handed way that he's been attacked from kind of both sides. He told this great story at the conference about how the leader, organizer of a liberal Baptist convention in Virginia got in touch with his publisher and wanted to order 5,000 copies of the book. Now, for an academic, this is like, that doesn't happen. And so they were very excited. And then 2 weeks later, they called back and canceled the entire order. And they said, what happened? And they said, well, we actually read the book, and it doesn't actually help us combat the conservatives in our denomination as strongly as we'd like, so we can't really use it. And then from the other angle, he's been kind of targeted by people making this Christian nation argument as well. Although he would be the first to say he's trying to make this argument as a historian and as a faithful Christian. So the issue. like everything else that touches on politics in our country right now, the debate over the origins of Christian origins of America and the implications of that debate for the country today is fiercely polarized. One side of the debate argues that the United States was founded by Christian men on Christian principles, and that this means that we're justified to some extent in demanding that Christian principles be imposed in the public sphere today. The other side of the debate argues just as passionately that the historical accomplishment of the United States was to separate religion and religious belief from the political sphere, thus freeing both religion and the state to flourish according to their own purposes and designs, and that the nation was fundamentally a product not of any Christian heritage, but of an Enlightenment rationality that not only questioned the existence of God, but also sought to create a wholly secular state, free from the influence of religion and religious leaders. During the 2008 presidential campaign, for instance, John McCain set off a new round in this debate when he declared during a radio interview that the Constitution, quote, had established the United States as a Christian nation. While the debate frequently plays out in podiums of political elections or in debates between pundits on television talk shows, its roots lie in two contrasting bodies of writing. One great example of this is two recent books on Thomas Jefferson, okay? Typically a kind of hero of the secularist side of this argument. On one side of the debate stand figures like David Barton, profiled by Time magazine in 2005 as one of the 25 most, in 2005 as one of the 25 most influential evangelicals in America. The author of multiple books on the role of faith in the founding of the nation, Barton's most recent book is called The Jefferson Lies, and it portrays about how Jefferson has been portrayed inaccurately as a kind of secularist, and also specifically Barton focuses on the claim that Jefferson fathered a child with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, and claims that there's no evidence to support this. Jefferson was, in Barton's words, a, quote, pro-Christian and pro-Jesus person, and certainly not the atheist that historians have portrayed him. Barton is also concerned to defend Jefferson against charges that he fathered a child with his slave, Sally Hemings. Barton admits that Jefferson had some doubts about, quote, specific Christian doctrines, but portrays Jefferson overall as one of the founders of a broadly Christian nation. Barton's book shows just how polarized the Christian nation's debates are because Jefferson typically is a hero for the secularist side of this argument. On the other side, in the kind of secular vein, is Thomas Jefferson, author of America, a book penned by the late Christopher Hitchens, who just died last year, or a few months ago. Hitchens, of course, is more famous for writing, for being one of these new atheists, who his most famous book in that vein was called God Is Not Great. And to Hitchens, Jefferson is a hero because he was the father of this modern secularist state where he kind of infused Enlightenment rationality into the DNA of the American nation. There's a whole variety of books on both sides of this issue, some of them taking the side of Hitchens. A recent one is called The Godless Constitution, arguing that the Constitution establishes a strictly secular state. And on the other side, you have books like America's Godly Heritage, another popular book called, I think, The Light and the Glory. Some of you may be, I certainly encountered that growing up. In the book, what Fia argues is that as we look at these debates, what we need to do is examine the question itself. And then, to really get at it historically, we have to do a few things. So was America founded as a Christian nation? Well, the part of the problem with these debates is the question itself. Historians place a great deal of emphasis on asking the right sort of questions of the past, the sort of questions that the past can actually answer in useful ways. And this one doesn't lend itself to any clear answers. It depends, for instance, on what we mean by terms like founded, Christian, and even nation. It depends on what we mean by those, what answers we'll get. For instance, did the pilgrims found America when they landed on the east coast of North America in the 17th century? Or did the founding come 2 centuries later during the American Revolution with the Declaration of Independence, or a decade after that with the Constitution? On which of these foundings do we base our claim that America was a Christian nation? And what do we mean by Christian? Most of those who argue today either for or against the idea of America as a Christian nation have in mind the evangelical Christianity that permeates the so-called religious right today. But how does our own religious atmosphere compare to that of the early 17th or late 18th centuries, depending on whether you're talking about, you know, the Puritans or the American Revolution? Should we define Christianity by orthodoxy, a belief in traditional historic Christian doctrines? Or should we define it by what Fia calls orthopraxy, that these people acted in ways or lived up to Christian ideals? That seems like a particularly dangerous way to define it to me. And finally, by nation, do we mean the legal and political entity established by the structure of the Constitution? Or do we simply mean that the majority of people living in the United States then, in between, and now were Christians or had sympathy with Christian principles? So the question itself is part of the problem, and the problem is that this question gets lobbed out and then kind of batted back and forth on TV by pundits in really unhelpful ways. So one of the things we have to do is to think historically about this question. One of the main problems is the current debate that it proceeds according to a fundamentally anti-historical and ahistorical agenda. Both sides essentially mine the past for tidbits that support their argument in the present, with no respect for the integrity, context, or complexity of the past. Going hunting for what historians sometimes call a usable past inevitably does violence to our ability to see the past on its own terms and ends up giving us a past that looks a lot like the present, or at least how we want the present to look. For instance, those who want to argue for the idea of a Christian nation usually count up references to God or a creator or instances of founding fathers praying or attending church. And from these snapshots argue that these sorts of people would undoubtedly found a Christian nation. So defenders of the Christian ideal point to words in the Declaration which invoke the laws of nature and of nature's God and declare that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. They point to the pronouncements of George Washington in his farewell address, in which Washington declared that religion was one of the, quote, indispensable supports of political prosperity. They point out how often Washington invoked the idea of providence in American victory. On the other side, those who want to prove the secular origins of America have their own repertoire of historical tidbits. One of their favorites is the Treaty of Tripoli, which the United States signed with the country of Tripoli on the coast of Africa in 1797. And this was part of a conflict over piracy. The Barbary pirates were preying on U.S. shipping. And in the treaty with this Muslim nation, we read this in Article 11. The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, period, end quote. So a treaty designed to be a kind of instrument of negotiation with a Muslim nation whose theology was telling them that it was okay to prey on American shipping because these were infidels, is kind of taken out of its historical context and used as kind of ammunition in this debate, without contextualizing it. The Constitution itself, with its noticeable lack of religious language and the Bill of Rights barring the establishment of religion, is another mainstays of the argument for a secular America. Critics of Christian America point to the skepticism and deism of many of the founders, especially Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. The deism is the kind of 18th century belief that there is a God that created the world and then kind of stepped back from it, wound up the clock, and no longer intervenes in human affairs. None of these arguments do any justice to the past on its own terms. Historians have this saying that they use all the time, and they stole it from a British novelist named L.P. Hartley. And the quote goes like this: "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." And by this, what historians kind of draw from this is that you have to approach the past on its own terms, in its own context, before you can really begin to explain how it relates to the present. Both sides of this debate approach the evidence in decidedly different way than this. Both of them kind of mine the past for tidbits that support either way. They approach it more as lawyers in some ways, finding evidence that will support one or the other side. And this is not what historians do at all. We cannot make leaps directly from the 18th century to today. To take one example that all of us are kind of familiar with, most of us would say that it's beneficial in studying the Bible to know not only original languages, but cultural context. This is how we study scripture to apply it to ourselves today, right? That you have to know that context. So, Phia, the first thing that he does is examines the history of the idea itself that America was a Christian nation. How long have Americans thought that this was a Christian nation? How many of them thought that? Who used this argument? It ends up that actually the religious right today is not the first group to even argue about this or use it in support of a political platform. And that at one time, of course, Phia discovers most Americans assumed that they did live in a Christian nation. So Phia points specifically to the period between the ratification of the Constitution in 1789 and the Civil War in 1865 as a period when most Americans simply assumed that they lived in a Christian nation. Now, we can't generalize too much before 1789 because what happens in the late 18th century, early 19th century, beginning in 1800 and 1801, is the Second Great Awakening, which arguably gives us the kind of shape of kind of modern evangelicalism in the United States today. But during that period, most Americans assumed they lived in a Christian nation. For instance, Noah Webster, the father of Webster's Dictionary, published a history of the United States in 1832, which began not with the Revolution or even with the Pilgrims, but in the Garden of Eden. And he linked American destiny with human destiny in general. So it was this continuum. Americans during this period didn't use the term Christian nation kind of polemically in an argument as if someone would disagree with them. They used it simplistically as a kind of matter of fact. We live in a Christian nation, not a Muslim nation, not a Buddhist nation. It was assumed that they lived in a Christian nation. And Phia says, in this respect, for this period of history, Christian nationalists have a good portion of history on their sides, if by Christian nation you mean that most Americans understood that they lived in one. The Civil War shattered this harmony, at least temporarily. Historian Mark Knoll has called the Civil War a theological crisis. Abraham Lincoln spoke to this at the time in his second inaugural when he says, "Both sides pray to the same God, read the same Bible." Both the North and the South in the Civil War claimed to be kind of particularly Christian nations. But there were some interesting wrinkles to that. Southerners, for instance, portrayed the North as a godless society ruled by a godless constitution. They critique the U.S. Constitution for its lack of religious language. Southern Presbyterian Benjamin Morgan Palmer denounced what he called the perilous atheism of the U.S. Constitution, and many Southern Christians agreed. In fact, some Northern Christians agreed. William Lloyd Garrison, before the Civil War, an abolitionist, had called the Constitution a pact with the devil, not only because it authorized slavery, sanctioned slavery, but because it didn't invoke the name of God or Jesus Christ. During the war, some Northern clergy formed an association called the National Reform Association, the NRA. That tried to amend the Constitution specifically to acknowledge God and Jesus Christ. Their efforts were unsuccessful, but the organization itself lived on well into the 20th century attempting to insert this amendment into the Constitution. On the Southern side, Southerners specifically invoked God in the Southern Constitution. And if many Southern evangelicals had had their way, would have specifically invoked Jesus Christ as well. But they specifically invoked God because they saw the U.S. Constitution as kind of this godless document. Another interesting, so after the Civil War, it fractures. And people begin having arguments over what it means to be a Christian nation, who are we and what does this mean in the public square. One of the most interesting facets of this is that Fia says in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, conservative kind of evangelical Christians were actually, and Rick touched on this in his talk a couple months ago, were actually unlikely to make the argument that America was a Christian nation because they were influenced by this kind of premillennial eschatology that was pushing them to withdraw from society. These are during the era of debates over evolution and Darwinism and things like this. And the people most strongly making the argument for America as a Christian nation are actually mainline social liberals who are pursuing kind of a social gospel Christianity where they want to redeem society. And their argument is that America is a Christian nation, therefore the federal government should be involved in all these social problems and programs and those sorts of things. So from the early 20th century to today, those two camps have flipped. But in the early 20th century, mainline liberal Protestants were actually the most likely to make this argument. One of the most famous examples, but we don't always think of it this way, is that Martin Luther King in the Civil Rights Movement used the idea of America as a Christian nation to kind of as moral leverage over Americans. He called them to live up to, if you read the letter from the Birmingham jail, it's a very nationalistic document, but it's also an appeal to fellow pastors and Americans to kind of live up to these common ideals. So there's a long, Fia has a long section about how the civil rights movement used this idea of America as a Christian nation as leverage. Finally, probably the most important context for the idea of America as a Christian nation during the 20th century is the Cold War. Originating after World War II, U.S. Enters into this, you know, decades-long simmering conflict with the Soviet Union and communism all over the world. And one of the fundamental ways to define America in distinction from communism was Christianity. So in the 1950s is when In God We Trust is inserted onto our money and when Under God is inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance. And these things were specifically designed to kind of distinguish us from the Soviet Union and communism, which were not just seen as, they were actively kind of anti-religious and atheistic. So the history itself of the idea has a very, and then of course the religious right is kind of the next step in that, right? And that argument is bound up with all sorts of things like Roe versus Wade. Many people point to that, the social revolutions of the 60s, and things like that. So Fia covers this whole long kind of spectrum of the history of this idea that America was a Christian nation. And then he goes back and examines several specific questions. Three, really. Was the American Revolution in any way a fundamentally Christian event? Did the Constitution found a Christian nation? And were the founders Christians? And I should say up front that FIA doesn't offer, this is why the Baptist didn't buy the book, FIA doesn't offer hard-cut answers, yes or no answers to any of these, but I think they're very kind of useful answers. So for instance, if we're going to talk about the American Revolution, actually, maybe you need to start with the colonies, right? So two examples that we could use are Jamestown and the Puritan colonies in New England. So Jamestown, founded in 1607, most of the colonists at Jamestown, although they brought their Anglicanism with them, see themselves not even as founding a nation, but as simply extending the British Empire. So we look at Jamestown and the Puritan colonies through the lens of the American Revolution and the Constitution, and we kind of read into the origins where it's going to go. But at the time, people simply saw themselves as kind of extending the British Empire further into the wilderness, right? Jamestown, it's clear, if you lived long enough in Jamestown to grow tobacco, you could get rich. And this was certainly the main motivation of people coming to Jamestown. As I said, they bring their Anglicanism with them, and actually Jamestown is governed by, in an attempt to kind of bolster discipline in the colony, a set of laws called the Laws Divine, Moral, and Martial is instituted by one of the first governors of Jamestown, who was a British official. So on the surface, it can seem they're certainly invoking Christian principles. One of the problems with this is the way that these laws are sometimes applied. So under the Laws Divine, Moral, and Martial, one famous example is that a colonist is caught stealing oatmeal from a communal store. And under the laws, this colonist is tied to a tree, and a needle is stuck through his tongue, and he's left to starve to death. So Jamestown, and that's not the only example like that I could tell, Jamestown is a really rough place, mostly focused on people, on economic advantage. That's why people came to Jamestown. If you could live long enough, grow enough tobacco, get enough slaves, eventually you could make money there. The Puritan colonies in New England, of course, it's easier to make the claim that these were specifically intended as Christian societies, conscious attempts at creating Christian societies. And so many proponents of Christian America focus on these colonies. And as far as it goes, this is a good argument. John Winthrop aboard the Arbella says that, you know, these colonists are entering into a covenant with God. They see church and state as kind of one unit during this time. There are people that dissent from this vision. So people like Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island, who we associate with the separation of church and state. What we don't sometimes realize about Williams is that he left or was kicked out of Massachusetts because he was arguing that the church and state should be separated, that people shouldn't have to attend services kind of mandatorily. Because he thought that compromised the purity of the church. He believed that you shouldn't have non-believers attending church with the elect, and therefore you should have this separation, and he's kicked out of Massachusetts for that. But certainly those colonies are a strong argument, although you have to make the argument that that's where America began, right? Not Jamestown, which was actually earlier, but those colonies, and not the Catholic Spanish colonies that preceded those, but didn't end up founding their own nation, like St. Augustine, Florida. Then FIA moves on to the Revolution. What is the Revolution? Can we see the Revolution as any kind of fundamentally Christian event? And he gives a brief overview of the events that lead up to the Revolution, The French and Indian War, the Stamp Act crisis, the Boston Tea Party, Lexington, the shot heard around the world. And he says, on the one hand, there's nothing specific, there's not a lot of religious content in the conflict that led to the revolution. In other words, this isn't a war over religion in any specific sense. So in that sense, the rights that the colonists are invoking are English rights, not Christian rights. One example is that in response to the Stamp Act, the Virginia Resolves are one response to the Stamp Act in 1765. And the Virginia Resolves cite inherent rights and privileges for the citizens of Virginia. And when we hear that, we think of the Declaration of Independence and the justification of rights endowed by a creator. But the inherent rights and privileges that the Virginia Resolves invoke are actually simply the rights that they should have as English citizens. It doesn't make an appeal to anything larger than that. On the other hand, during the Revolution, the clergy consistently preached kind of in favor of the revolution. And this is one of the really interesting facets. A lot of historians actually point to this as kind of there's this fusion between Christianity and democratic ideals during the revolution. Sophia says, many of the clergy are preaching that the revolution is just, that it's holy, that this is a righteous cause. But he also does a really interesting analysis of their of their sermons. And he points out a couple things about the sermons. Is two of the texts that ministers frequently kind of struggle with in these sermons are Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2. Both of which are sections of scripture that teach obedience to authority, right? And Fia kind of concludes that the revolutionists never really deal with these texts. What they end up doing is going to the biblical text and then reverting to kind of arguments about natural liberty and the right of people to revolt against kings and those sorts of things. Added to that is, especially in an area like Calvinistic New England, is the fact that people like John Calvin preached or wrote that you needed to always submit to legitimate authority, right? So Calvin wrote this, if we keep firmly in mind that even the worst kings are appointed by the same decree which establishes the authority of kings, then we will never permit ourselves the seditious idea that a king is to be treated according to his deserts, or that we need not obey a king who does not conduct himself toward us like a king. We must honor the worst tyrant in the office in which the Lord has seen fit to set him. So Fia makes this argument that ministers are almost consistently on the side of the American Revolution, but that the arguments that they give in favor of the revolution typically come from secular sources rather than biblical sources, which is a really interesting argument, I think. So the revolution, yes and no, the Declaration of Independence. Did the Declaration of Independence found a Christian nation? Okay, so moving quickly here. On the one hand, the First and Second Continental Congresses constantly invoke God, specifically, Jesus Christ, specifically. They call fast days, days of thanksgiving. Congress asked colonists to, in 1776, in March of 1776, Congress asked colonists to, quote, confess and bewail our manifold sins and transgressions, and by a sincere repentance of amendment of life, appease his righteous displeasure, and through the merits and mediation of Jesus Christ, obtain his pardon and forgiveness, imploring his assistance to frustrate the cruel purposes of our unnatural enemies. Congress even goes so far as to consider printing an American Bible. They don't have the money. So does any of this mean that... So on the one hand, they're obviously Christian people at work here, right? But can we use that to say that these people would necessarily have used the Declaration, and say this again about the Constitution, to found a Christian nation? As a document, was it intended to found a Christian nation? It can be evidence that there were Christians at the founding, but is it in fact evidence of that we were founded as a Christian nation? Fia says no. The Declaration was not primarily intended to help Americans reflect on their own identity or the national identity. The Declaration is essentially a foreign policy document. It was meant to establish the U.S. in the kind of community of nations. And in doing that, it doesn't appeal to kind of radical doctrines. We tend to view the Declaration that way. But it appeals to a lot of concepts that many European nations would have already agreed with. The idea of natural rights. Jefferson had gotten this from European philosophers, so it's not surprising he uses it. In fact, in 1825, Jefferson wrote this about the Declaration. When forced to resort to arms for redress, an appeal to the tribunal of the world was deemed proper. This was the object of the Declaration, not to find out new principles or new arguments never before thought of, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain as to command their assent. So in one sense, we have to take into account the purposes of the Declaration. On the other hand, if we want to talk about references to God in the Declaration, there are four references in the Declaration, and most of them are consistent with a kind of deistic interpretation of God, someone who created the material order and kind of stepped back. But Fia points out that at the end of the Declaration, they used this word providence, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. Now, to us today, most of the arguments for Christian nations focus on providence, but don't really kind of comprehend what it means, which was that in the context of the 18th century, the idea of providence implied an active, interfering God, a God who actively kind of ordained human events and even stepped into human affairs. So its inclusion in the Declaration actually goes beyond most of the other references. So, the Declaration. We'll do the Constitution here quickly, and then I'll finish up. The interesting thing about the Constitution is that it doesn't invoke God or found, in fact, right, the First Amendment prohibits the establishment of religion. And Fia makes a couple interesting points about this. We argue about the Constitution today through the lens of a couple centuries of the increasing prominence of central government in American life, mainly because of things like the Civil War. But at the time, when the Constitution is framed, many Americans, including most of the framers, assume that the most important work is actually going to be done at the state level. So the Constitution doesn't allow any establishment of religion at the federal level, but in the years right before and after the Constitution is framed, you had at least two models of how this could work out at the state level. In Virginia, Jefferson is the author of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, which disestablishes any religion. No taxes could be levied to support clergy. And Jefferson saw this as a kind of win for freedom of conscience. But in Massachusetts, they had kind of blatant establishment of religion before and after. It's not until into the 19th century that Massachusetts disestablishes religion. If you lived in Massachusetts, even under the Constitution, you paid taxes to support a minister. And if you didn't have a minister, you still paid taxes to support the local Congregationalist minister. So even though the Constitution, in other words, what Fia says is, it wasn't intended to answer this question of whether or not the nation would be a Christian nation. It was assumed that this was going to be worked out at the state level, and it was, right, in many ways. And people like John Adams are involved in Massachusetts in framing this state constitution that establishes religion and taxes them for it. One of the phrases that gets thrown around a lot in this debate is the idea of a wall of separation between the church and the state. And most people think that this phrase occurs in the Constitution, but it actually doesn't. It comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1802. It actually comes from Roger Williams, a Puritan who left Massachusetts to found Rhode Island. But Jefferson used it again in an 1802 letter, and then it was picked up in that 1802 letter and used by the Supreme Court to interpret the First Amendment. So the Supreme Court said, okay, in 1802 Jefferson used this phrase, wall of separation. Well, that must imply what the intentions were for the First Amendment. So what's interesting is that in that 1802 letter, Jefferson is writing to the Danbury Baptist Association in Connecticut, which wrote to Jefferson complaining that that they weren't being treated equally in Connecticut. Congregationalism was the established denomination of Connecticut, and the Baptists write to Jefferson, who had just been elected president, to complain about this. And Jefferson writes back and says, well, you really should do it the way we did it in Virginia and the way I would like everybody else to see it, which is establishing this wall of separation between church and state. Then, the next day, Jefferson attends a worship service in Congress, in the House of Representatives, led by John Leland, a Virginia Baptist. And Fia looks at these two things and says, okay, on one day he uses this phrase, wall of separation. The next day he attends a worship service in the House of Representatives, led by a Baptist minister. Obviously, Jefferson didn't mean by this phrase kind of what we mean by it. So that's an interesting point. Okay, in the last couple minutes is Fia moves then to an examination of the beliefs of the founders. And this is, he kind of does this simply because everybody brings this up. And there's a couple main points. On the one side, you have figures like George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, whose beliefs we could characterize certainly as not orthodox in some ways. Washington is the closest. Washington continually appeals to these ideas of providence in his letters. But Washington has to be understood within the context of 18th century Anglicanism, a primarily liturgical tradition. Washington famously never took communion after the American Revolution. He would always leave before they took communion. His wife Martha would stay, and Washington would leave and go home and send the carriage back for her. And a minister, when Washington was president, called him out on this in front of the entire congregation and said, the leader of the country should be taking communion. And Washington submitted to the rebuke and then never came to a communion service again. He would go to all the other services, but never the communion services. On the other hand, Washington uses in his private correspondence is the most prolific user of this idea of providence, that God actively kind of ordained the American Revolution and found, you know, that God moved in the affairs of men. In fact, you can go through Adams, Jefferson, and Franklin. None of these people believed in many of the kind of core orthodox positions of historic Christianity, like the divinity of Christ. Adams was a Unitarian. Jefferson was kind of a deist. Franklin was more of kind of a deistic, a moralist. They all believed in a God, but not in his specific manifestation in Christ, although they all professed that the Christian religion was probably the best one. On the other hand, all those founders, even though they don't kind of live up to our ideas of Orthodox Christianity today, believe deeply in two ideas, Pia says. They all believed in this idea of providence, that God could ordain and step into human affairs, and they all believed that religion was fundamental to a virtuous society, that without religion, you couldn't have a virtuous society. Then he moves to other founders who are religiously orthodox, people like John Witherspoon, one of the signers of the Declaration, who's the president of Princeton, following Jonathan Edwards and other figures like that at Princeton. John Witherspoon, John Jay, first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Samuel Adams, and Patrick Henry, one of my favorites. Patrick Henry is the give me liberty or give me death, right? Kind of a passionate, kind of evangelical in a lot of ways. Although, what's interesting about Henry is that he goes on to passionately oppose the Constitution. Henry believes that the Constitution is a betrayal of all the ideals of the American Revolution. So he's an ambiguous figure for people arguing that we're established as a Christian nation. So, conclusion, last paragraph. By using history to support a simplistic version of America as a Christian or a secular nation, the two sides of this debate don't do history justice. By making shaky arguments about the founders, some modern-day defenders of the Christian nation idea undermine Christians' ability to make real and complex points about the role of Christianity in the founding of the nation, and legitimate questions about the role of religion in our country today. For instance, in his book on Jefferson, David Barton claims that Jefferson was pro-Christian and pro-Jesus, that he was a man of simple tastes, Barton writes, unpretentious, living and acting as the common person for whom he had sacrificed so much, and that he certainly did not father a child with Sally Hemings. He also accuses historians of wrongly labeling Jefferson atheist. However, we know that Jefferson, for instance, established the University of Virginia as a place where, quote, a professorship of theology would have no place. We also know, you know, the famous example of how Jefferson excises the Bible, takes all the miracles and anything supernatural out, and creates his own Bible. We know that when Jefferson died, this is just illustrating a kind of historical inaccuracy, his tastes in French wine and clothing were so extravagant that his descendants had to sell his estate. He was not a man of simple tastes at all. We know from DNA evidence done in a famous 1998 study that a male Jefferson, perhaps not Thomas Jefferson, but somebody in his direct family, fathered a child with Sally Hemings, his slave. And no historian has ever labeled Jefferson an atheist, but he certainly denied the divinity of Christ and excised the miraculous from his Bible. These sorts of simplistic arguments undermine more important discussions about the undeniable influence of Christianity on America's founding. But those questions are complicated and require careful consideration. Thank you. And now, 5 minutes for questions. That's how I did it on purpose. No, not really. Yeah, Alice.
You talked at the beginning about the legitimacy of the question.
Yeah.
So, from your viewpoint today, why are we asking this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the intent of those people who want to dismiss the foundations of people who believe that we are?
We're
through history and are now.
I think, I mean, the play, this is one of the debates that's raging right now is going on in North Carolina over a same-sex marriage bill. And both sides are making these arguments about were we or were we not founded as a Christian nation. And I think the impetus behind it is that it lends a kind of authenticity or legitimacy to your argument, rather than simply arguing about kind of the morality of it or the benefit of it in our society. you can say, well, the founders would have supported me. The founders have become our version of scripture, right? If you can get the founders on your side, that's a legitimate case. I think that's what's behind it.
This is an aside. We try to do that with the Westminster Confession.
Right.
You know, what did they have? Yeah. Was there an intent on certain phrases?
Right. A recent book on the Declaration is titled American Scripture, and that's the argument essentially that we, which perhaps is an argument that, in one funny sense, that we are a Christian nation because we want to go back to the founding documents and get it right? That if we can go back and determine it there, you know, then we can figure it out. Yeah.
What would you say would be an important question about this?
I think the most important question is actually Rick's question 2 months ago. I think the really important question is, what role does religion play in this idea of virtue, and do we need that in the public square, and how do we get that, and what is the relationship of religion to that? Do we want the government to reflect our beliefs in any specific sense? Do we want to legislate those beliefs, or do we want to keep that private and kind of influence it from the ground up, kind of thing, right? But I think that argument is a better one to have than, you know, did the Constitution establish a Christian nation? Maybe. I don't know if that totally makes sense, but I think that's one of the things, and that's that, just me saying that question, right? That's not nearly as exciting a question as, you know, how many times does the word God occur in the Declaration of Independence or something like that. But it's more complex. It's a deeper, weightier question. I mean, what is the role of religion in public life? What should it be?
So any good arguments by either side are bringing their points. So what? Suppose we were part of the Christian nation. Are there any good arguments that say it should change, or that it should change,
yeah,
or is relevant to anything?
I think that's one of the questions that just gets thrown out the window is, okay, how did we establish this whole thing by which we skip two centuries of history and go back to the founding, and that determines how we should be doing things today? Now, we do this with I think we're conditioned to do this, but how we look at the Constitution and how our courts interpret the Constitution. Let me read you a quick quote that I excised from the, speaking of that, from the conference that I went to last time. So Mark Knoll, who's a historian at Notre Dame, gave a talk sort of relating to this book. And he said that this is one of the fundamental things about this question. He says, in general, when contemporary political discussions spill over into debates about the national heritage, sound bites proliferate, and partisan history flourishes, and discriminating use of the past is the first casualty. Yet, if those who want to bring the American past to bear on the current court and legislative decisions follow John Fea and get their history straight, it would still require careful reasoning to say exactly how the precedents of a seaboard nation of 3 million Anglo-Saxons and enslaved Africans should guide the actions of a continental nation of 300 million ethnically, religiously, and economically diverse citizens. I think that's one of the fundamental questions, is that we can use, we can look back and have this debate, but we need to have it in the present and not so much in the past, which is a strange thing for a historian to say.
Rick, could you reflect just a little bit on sort of the past sort of culture wars, that term culture war in the sense of that, and how an understanding of a Christian, for those that advocate, we were a Christian nation, and how that influences the call to either fight or not fight a culture war.
I think that, so the culture wars and the modern argument over Christian nationalism dates to a couple things. It dates to, I said Roe versus Wade. You could certainly date it to kind of the sexual revolution of the 1960s, the kind of social foment of that. You could date it to the 1965 repeal by Lyndon Johnson of an earlier immigration act that established quotas for immigrating to the United States. After 1965, immigration jumps. We become more pluralistic than we were between World War I and the 1960s. And the centennial, the 1976 bicentennial of the nation. There's this kind of perfect confluence of things in the 60s and 70s in court cases like Roe v. Wade, where all of a sudden people have to confront again kind of who are we? You know, as Americans, who are we? And I think one of the reactions to that is to look back and say, who were we? Because that's one way that we can define what we should be now, which in some ways I think is you have to be able to define yourself in the present. But I don't know if that really answers your question. But I think it's an argument about, you know, who we should be right now in a lot of ways. Al?
Just coming to my head, is there anything that we can learn, like, from what Europe has struggled through with these questions, even though just being how to apply, how you deal with looking at the past and yet forging, you know, a future?
What's interesting about the European context is that in some ways, Americans inherit the idea of a Christian nation from the European past, right? Certainly, many of those nations would have applied themselves as kind of Christian because of this establishment of church and state. But then what happens is this flip, where in the American Revolution and soon thereafter, Christianity is kind of welded together. I guess I'm showing my cards a little bit here. It's kind of welded together in some complex ways with kind of American political DNA. It's associated with things like democracy and, you know, values and things like that. Whereas in Europe, you have this divergence where Christianity is seen as antithetical to all those things. The French Revolution is a totally different revolution in that regard. It's an anti-religious, anti-clerical, anti-everything, religion, revolution, revolution. And the American Revolution is the exact opposite. The American Revolution, the clergy are so on board that it ties, even though the eventual result is to disestablish religion, it ties popular religion into popular politics in the United States in a way that's true nowhere in Europe.
Okay, well, Bob, thanks for your good.